Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good afternoon and welcome on behalf of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and the Center for Economic and Social Rights and all of us who are gathered here today to what now is the third in a series of conversations here at United Nations headquarters on the place of human rights in the post-2015 agenda. These halls are full of delegations, civil society representatives, and others who are very much engaged now in this discussion around what the post-2015 development framework will look like, what it should like more look like, more importantly, for our purposes. And today we're going to hone in, I think, with the help of all of you, on a particular aspect of the human rights message that we have been trying to send over the course of the last couple of years in this process. I've always remembered this quote from the Secretary General, who in his 2010 report to this General Assembly gathering that was looking back on the Millennium Development Goals and seeing where we needed to go to complete the job, he said that, you know, the goals the commitments have not been met, not because the goals were unreachable, not because there was an absence of resources or an absence of effort, but because there has been a lack of accountability. That effectively what wasn't written into the MDG framework as strongly as it needed to be were real meaningful notions of accountability. Well, the people who are sitting up at this table think that the international human rights framework has a lot to give to strengthening accountability in these endeavors, and we're going to talk about that in some detail. The interesting thing is, while this has come from the top, from delegations here at United Nations headquarters in New York, from the Secretary General, the High Commissioner for Human Rights, and others, it's also a message that's been very much, as we had a chance to discuss yesterday, been bubbling up from, let me say, from the streets, from people in countries in all regions around the world. We know this because there have been a series of national and regional and local and global consultations to try to hear what civil society, what people who are living the realities of development are saying about what needs to be in a global development framework. And there, too, we know, just to quote from a synthesis report that brought together all of the results of these global thematic and national consultations, which summarized that, quote, people are demanding a framework that holds governments and others to account for the implementation of their commitments in the post-2015 agenda, and they're presenting human rights as a non-negotiable element of this accountability. So we see this coming now from all directions. We understand why this is the case. I think that will emerge from our conversation. But the big question that remains, of course, is how? How do we ensure a framework which is adequately linked in human rights terms to the kind of accountability that we expect from governance, governance at the national level, governance also at the global level? And to try to feed into this, of course, we are launching today this publication. Let me say that those of you who are in the room can get a free copy up here at the front of the room. Please do take one. Please also sign up so that the summary version that we'll be mailing out will come to you as well. And there's a sign-up sheet here. For those of you who are following us on the webcast or on YouTube, you can get a hold of this from the website of the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, www.ohchr.org. Who will be accountable? Human rights in the post-2015 agenda is a publication that was produced jointly by our office, but together with the Center for Economic and Social Rights. And we're going to be hearing from our colleagues at the center today as well. So this publication is being launched today. It's being launched in this room for this purpose. But what we really want to do is to use this as an opportunity to talk a bit more about the how of accountability from a human rights perspective. This was one of the gaps in the MDGs, to be sure. And filling it, we think, is going to mean making sure that we identify more clearly who are the rights holders and who are the duty bearers for any elements of a post-2015 agenda, language drawn, of course, from the international human rights frameworks. We want to see what kind of mechanisms can be established, mechanisms of accountability at all levels, at the local level, at the national level, at the regional level, and certainly at the international level as well. You know, to identify clearly where the responsibilities are, how those who are responsible can be answerable in public and transparent ways, and how when those things are not met, there can also be redress and enforceability provided. It means, of course, in human rights terms, making sure that we have clear benchmarks and indicators, that we have structured monitoring of the degree to which we are meeting our benchmarks and realizing the indicators. But we think it also means that it is important to try to align whatever is developed for the post-2015 framework with the existing international accountability framework, which we know as international human rights law. We have a wealth of mechanisms and standards that are already in place, that are binding on all member states, that are extending those norms now to actors in the private sector through the guiding principles on business and human rights, for example, and that can be used as an accountability framework just as easily for international institutions. And we're going to talk about how that might be done as well. We've got exactly the panel that you need to have that discussion, starting with Mr. Ignacio Saiz, who's the Executive Director of the Center for Economic and Social Rights. This is the organization that partnered with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights to produce the publication that you have before you today. He is also one of the principal authors in the development of that publication, and he'll be speaking with us today as we go forward. Janet Nelson is also joining us. She's a representative to the UN in Geneva of ATD Fourth World, civil society organization that's worked so much on human rights questions, including on the economic and social side. Of course, Janet has known to many of you through other hats that she's worn through the years at the World Council of Churches, a number of NGOs, a former UN colleague through UNICEF for quite a long time as well. And very much on the front lines of development from a rights-based perspective as well. You'll also know, many of you, Aldo Cagliari, who has joined us as well. Aldo has worked with us in particular on the international accountability side in so many ways through the years. He is from the Center for Concern, where he's currently a project director, focused very much on global economic governance, on debt, international financial architecture, all of that very relevant for accountability at the international level for the post-2015 agenda. Alessandro Motter, also with us. Thanks for being with us, Alessandro. He is a senior advisor at the Interparliamentary Union. And as I said, we're looking also for national political accountability, including through parliaments and other participatory democratic institutions at the national level. And Alessandro is well positioned to talk to us a bit about that aspect of accountability as well. And then we have a couple of hundred additional speakers, which is you. You meaning the people who are in the room. So we'll be calling on you to participate in this conversation after we hear some brief presentations from each of the panelists who have joined us to talk about these issues. Again, for those of you who have just come in the room, grab a free copy of the book that we're launching today, Who Will Be Accountable. Make sure that you sign up so that we can send you some subsequent publications on this subject. And with that, it's my great pleasure to give the floor to our co-producer of this publication, from the Center for Economic and Social Rights, Ignacio.
Many thanks, Craig, and many thanks to you all for turning up this lunchtime. As Craig says, this report speaks to two issues which have come very prominently to the fore in the discussions around what should replace the Millennium Development Goals in 2015. The issue of human rights and their relationship to the post-2015 agenda, and the issue of accountability and how accountability can be strengthened in the new framework. Craig also mentioned that from the worldwide consultations that have taken place so far, there's been a resounding call for human rights to be the normative bedrock of the post-2015 agenda, and for that normative bedrock to serve to deliver accountability in the language of the global conversation begins, the report that Craig cited. In many of the thematic as well as national consultations that have taken place around the globe, particularly the thematic consultation on governance, accountability has been a centerpiece of the debate. Governance is defined by many civil society participants in those discussions as being accountable, honest, transparent, and just governance. It's interesting to note also that accountable governance is one of the top concerns in the UN My World Global Survey, which canvassed opinions around which were the most salient issues to be covered in the new framework. Craig also mentioned that the gaps in accountability have been recognized by the UN Secretary General himself as one of the reasons why there are serious shortfalls in the achievement of many of the MDGs, at least some of them. Obviously, these shortfalls, many of them have to do with broader governance gaps at the national and international levels, which the current MDGs did little to address. But the accountability shortfalls also arise from the weakness in the formulation of the MDGs and in the architecture that was put in place for their implementation. In particular, and I don't have time to go into great detail, but the fact that many of the goals and targets are inconsistent in many ways with the provisions of pre-existing human rights standards, the weakness of MDG monitoring and review mechanisms that were put in place, the failure in many senses of the MDG framework to define clearly differentiated responsibilities. The emphasis was on shared responsibility rather than on common but differentiated responsibilities, as is the language of Rio. And fourthly, the misappropriation of these goals, which are global goals, as national planning targets. All of these, for different reasons, have undermined the fabric of accountability in the current framework. Obviously, these commitments are political commitments that therefore rely purely on political will for their translation into practice, as opposed to human rights law, which are a set of binding legal commitments with their corresponding monitoring and enforcement mechanisms. But the question that we were keen to explore with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights was the contribution that human rights standards and mechanisms can make to addressing these accountability gaps. Accountability is obviously the cornerstone of the human rights framework, and it's the foundation of a human rights-based approach to development. So aligning development goals more explicitly and more coherently with these binding legal obligations is not only a legal imperative, in the sense that states are already bound legally to these norms, it can also strengthen incentives to improve public policy performance, so helping to ensure that the new commitments agreed in 2015 are truly honored in practice. So I'm just going to say a couple of words about what's in the report by way of introduction. I don't want to hog the time on the panel, and you hopefully will all have a copy of the report to take away with you. We begin by looking at accountability from a human rights perspective, and we identify three dimensions of accountability. These are not necessarily derived from human rights law, but actually are drawn more from the development literature and development understandings of accountability. And these three dimensions are responsibility, answerability, and enforceability. I was hoping to have a slide here where I could put up the definitions of these so as not to have to read them. But let me give you a sense of what we mean by these dimensions. And how human rights standards can help to inform each of these. This is the more conceptual part of the inquiry. Human rights standards make it possible to delineate what governments and other actors in the development process are responsible for, to delineate responsibilities. So, as you know, the core human rights treaties set out very specific steps that governments are obliged to take to respect, protect, and fulfill rights. So if human development commitments are underpinned by these pre-existing human rights obligations, accountability for the goals becomes a matter of legal obligation rather than of charity or discretion. Secondly, answerability. Anchoring development commitments in human rights standards helps to create the conditions through which people can hold those in authority answerable for their actions. And here, the dimensions of the human rights agenda that correspond to freedoms of expression, information, assembly, and association are particularly critical for answerability because they make it possible for people to meaningfully participate in decision-making processes, to challenge the actions of public officials, and to exercise active citizenship. And thirdly, enforceability. Grounding development commitments in the human rights framework can reinforce accountability by providing additional mechanisms through which people can enforce their rights and seek redress when these are violated as a result of a failure to fulfill development commitments. Obviously, not all failure to fulfill a development commitment is necessarily a human rights violation, but we are concerned here with those failures or incompliances which do trample on people's rights. And our point in the report is that an array of national and international mechanisms exist to assess the claims and grievances of those who suffer unjust treatment in the development process, to determine responsibilities through fair and transparent processes, and where appropriate, to provide appropriate remedies. We do spend some time in the report looking at the what of accountability. In a sense, in a nutshell, the report can be seen as an examination of the what, the who, and the how of accountability. And I want to spend more time on how. But we do delve a lot into the question of how human rights standards and the array of provisions can help to define responsibilities and how responsibilities are framed under the goals and targets. It looks at how abstract principles like indivisibility, non-discrimination, universality, progressive realization, how these concretely should inform how the goals and targets are framed. I clearly don't have time to go into much detail here, but just to highlight a couple of examples, more salient examples, indivisibility clearly requires a more balanced framework than we have currently. There is widespread recognition that issues of civil and political rights, the freedoms that I mentioned earlier, which are so critical to creating conditions of answerability, have really been overlooked to very serious and grave effect, as we've seen in the context of the Arab Spring. Human rights standards also demand much more accountability for reducing disparities and tackling discrimination. And again, this has come to the fore in the inequalities consultation. I won't say more than that. I'll just flag that point. A third point that I think human rights standards oblige us to think about in terms of the content of the new framework is around accountability, not just for results, but for the policy efforts that states make and for the resources that are invested in those efforts. Accountability for resources. This has a strong grounding in the human rights normative framework, which clearly puts an emphasis on conduct as well as results. Moving briefly on, in terms of who answers to whom, the report looks at several axes of accountability, if you like, interrelated accountability relationships. Clearly, the bond of accountability between the state and the citizen, which is the foremost concern of human rights law, is at the center of a much more elaborate web of accountability, which also takes into account actors above the state and beyond the state. The accountability relationship that, in a sense, has been most amply focused on in the MDG process to date has been the accountability relationship between states. But it's been a somewhat skewed examination of that relationship, with much more emphasis on the relationship of aid recipient countries to their donors than the supposed mutual accountability that the MDG framework was supposed to encourage. And in particular, it has been a great challenge in the current framework to hold international actors, global actors, second governments, more accountable for their commitments under the so-called Global Partnership for Development, MDG Goal 8, for reasons that I'll come to in a moment. So two points that we make about who is accountable. We feel that that human rights law, and particularly the emerging standards around responsibilities of corporate actors, and indeed the emerging notion of the extraterritorial obligations of states, provide strong grounding for commitments to be made in the new framework to be adopted in 2015, that really that prompts the corporate sector to really abide by certain fundamental consensus principles such as the do no harm principle, but also can be used to bring about greater accountability at the level of global economic governance, which has been one of the biggest deficits, as we've seen in the recent global economic crisis. I'm going to move on to the how of accountability, because I think that's the most important in our discussion today. In synthesis, our report basically argues two things. It argues that clearly there's a need for more effective accountability mechanisms of monitoring and review, which are specific to the new architecture, to the new development commitments, and we look and explore what characteristics those mechanisms should have and how they can be made fully participatory, inclusive, and responsive to the needs and experiences of those closest to poverty and deprivation. But a central thread of the report is also that there is an array of existing institutions of accountability, which can and should be more fully and effectively invoked and applied and used in the post-2015 framework. And we look in turn, the bulk of the report, in a sense, looks in turn at each of these. At the national level in particular, we look at administrative accountability mechanisms, such as charters and codes of conduct for public servants or citizen consultation groups. We look at independent oversight bodies such as national human rights commissions, which we believe have a much more important role, a much more effective role to play in monitoring development commitments than is currently the case, although we do highlight in the report some good practices. We look at judicial mechanisms as obviously fundamental in terms of the enforcement of human rights. And here we look at the obstacles that people living in poverty face in accessing justice through the courts. Despite these obstacles, litigation can and has been an important avenue of accountability. We highlight concrete cases in which individuals and communities have successfully obtained redress through judicial channels in ways that have had a much broader and systemic impact on their communities. And this is an important point. Judicial remedies of accountability are often seen as overly focused on individual sanction or overly punitive. But in fact, there's a whole body of case law from Colombia to South Africa to India that shows the transformative and systemically transformative potential of judicial enforcement of human rights, and particularly of economic and social rights. All these different accountability mechanisms that are discussed in the report are not isolated. In practice, they mutually reinforce one another in what we call in the report an ecosystem of accountability. The biggest gaps are at the international level. Clearly, we don't a system of global governance does not exist yet, where those actors above the state and beyond the state can be fully held to account for their commitments. And this has been manifest in the, if you look at where the shortfalls lie in the current MDG framework. MDG 8, the Global Partnership for Development, is woefully lagging behind, not just in terms of commitments to development finance, but also the effectiveness of the commitments or implementation of the commitments regarding states ensuring that their trade, investment, and debt policies do not constrain the ability of states, of developing states in particular, to honor their development and human rights commitments. And our proposals are that for the creation, if new mechanisms are contemplated for monitoring and reviewing compliance with international commitments at the international level, these must place particular emphasis on these accountability gaps. There are some good examples of MDG-specific mechanisms at the international level, which are either under construction or have begun to operate, which we believe are really worth highlighting and should be explored as potential models for replication in other areas. I'm thinking here in particular in the sector of maternal and child health. The Commission on Information and Accountability, set up as part of the Secretary General's strategy on maternal and child health, has done very innovative and very rigorous work to see how monitoring, review, and remedy, the monitoring function, the review remedy, the reviewing function, and remedying function of accountability can be informed by human rights standards. This process, which is just applies to this particular sector, currently MDGs 4 and 5, looks at issues of accountability for resources as well as accountability for outcomes. And for many reasons, we believe is a good model that is highlighted in the report that could be replicated in other sectors. I realize my time is probably up. One thing I wanted to highlight is that in this report has been in the making for quite some time. And so this is a very fast-moving debate and a fast-moving process. And when we started out, we were very keen to simply draw out broad parameters, learn some lessons from good practices, survey the field in terms of accountability mechanisms and how they can be effectively used in this context. But by the time we were finishing the report, the debate had got much more propositional. And so in the latter part of the report and also in the annex, we get into the question of accountability for making choices around the post-2015 content, around the post-2015 framework, because that process too must be rendered transparent and honor the principles of responsibility, answerability. And so we set out some criteria, which I don't have time to enumerate here, but some criteria based or informed by human rights standards, which can help states and others who are negotiating the content of the post-2015 framework to make choices, to make some of the tough judgment calls around what should be included in a post-2015 framework. Some of those criteria include, of course, consistency with international human rights standards, but also criteria such as global applicability, equality sensitivity. In other words, is this an issue which can help us to remedy the, in some cases, widening inequalities that we've seen on many grounds since the MDGs were first adopted, and so on and so forth. And so I would encourage you to look at that latter part of the report, which I think is engages in what is a very timely and important discussion going on right now. The consultations, the global consultations, have yielded a myriad proposals which are on the table. Clearly, we need a transparent and somewhat agreed framework for making choices. That in itself is a hallmark of accountability.
Thank you very much, Ignacio, for that excellent overview and of the framing of the report. And I really do want to take the opportunity to thank you personally, as well as your organization, for your leadership on this and for the great partnership that you've had with the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in producing this. I should mention also that we wanted Mac Darrow, who's the chief of our MDG section and who was the other principal partner in the drafting of the publication, to join us. He was unable to do so. But it's been an interesting process, and I think you've done a very good job of showing how the report lays out a new look at who, what, why, how, as you put it. But I think if there's anything in here that really is a paradigm shift in development, it's the additional piece, the to whom. In other words, the focus on human beings, on rights holders. I think, let's be honest, there's a lot of lip service that's given to people-centered development and people at the center and so on. But the structures of accountability, to the extent that they existed, the structures of delivery, the structures of international cooperation, are far away from really being focused on the beneficiaries or sometimes the victims of development, depending on how that development is pursued. And I think one of the most interesting things for me in this publication, it says, let's take that human rights framework and let's make sure that wherever you sit, if you're an international institution, if you're a donor, if you're a national government, your accountability, all of you, is to those on the ground who are supposed to be benefiting from that. That is a paradigm shift in the way development has been done, in spite of, I think, the lip service. Excellent overview, I think a very good way to get us started. You pointed out, and I think folks can have a look at the table of contents and see all of the levels of accountability that are examined in this publication, but I think one of the very interesting things is this notion of social accountability, you know, kind of digging a little bit deeper to make sure that we're not just talking about accountability up here, but we're talking also about accountability to and for the people who are the most marginalized, excluded, the poor, people who live in the communities that are supposed to be the focus of what we do. Janet, maybe you can pick up this piece and talk to us a little bit. We'll move on to other aspects of national political accountability, international accountability, but this idea of social accountability in the framework. Yeah.
Thank you, Craig. And first of all, I really want to commend your office as well as the CSSR for this excellent publication, because as an NGO that works in partnership with people living in extreme poverty, we couldn't agree more with its focus. You know, for us, it's very clear that if the international community is serious about eradicating poverty and especially extreme poverty, then it has to adopt a human rights approach. We, ATD Fourth World, works in both rich countries as well as developing countries, and from the high levels of poverty that we still see in rich countries, as well as the fact that so many of the developing countries did not meet MDG 1, it's clear that economic growth alone is not the solution to eradicating poverty. This reality has made some headway, I think, as seen in the fact that the Human Rights Council last September adopted what's called the Guiding Principles on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. And we consider the text to actually be groundbreaking because it affirms, and here I quote, that poverty is an urgent human rights concern in itself, because it is both a cause and a consequence of human rights violations and an enabling condition for other violations. So therefore, it stresses that extreme poverty is not just an issue of economic development, but also discrimination and social exclusion. And the fact that unless these are addressed, along with structural and systemic inequalities, then an unacceptable level of poverty will continue to be transmitted from generation to generation. So there's many issues we've seen in Geneva as we worked on the guiding principles, which took some 25 years of consultation to come to their final adoption. We've seen that there are a lot of disagreements on human rights and their role in terms of international development, but also in terms of the responsibility between the various actors at the international level. But we're very encouraged by the fact that these guiding principles were adopted by consensus. And we really hope that the fact that this does show one area of some level of consensus within the human rights realm, that the implications of human rights for guiding principles, at least those areas of human rights, can be reflected in the post-2015 agenda. On the issue of accountability, there's absolutely no question that it's particularly challenging when it comes to people living in extreme poverty, because they have very little, if no power whatsoever, when it comes to calling anyone to account, or much less claiming any form of redress, unless they have very serious support from other actors within society. The histories of discrimination and stigmatization make it very difficult for them to confront or even speak to people in authority, and usually the administrative and judicial procedures are much too cumbersome for them to deal with when they have to struggle just to survive. And so, unfortunately, there are not very many examples around the world of successful mechanisms that include affirmative action and the kinds of affirmative action that are required for people with a long history of human rights violations to actually be able to access mechanisms of accountability. This last year, ATD Fourth World has carried out with other partners a participatory research project to evaluate the MDGs from the point of view of people living in extreme poverty. So this means we were not looking at some of the big, the global mechanisms that Ignacio has referred to, but instead we were looking at what Craig has called social accountability network mechanisms. Because, legislation and judicial procedures are obviously important, but for people who are living extreme poverty, what are some of the mechanisms that need to be put into place in order to for there to be accountability on a day-to-day basis? In the course of this evaluation, we of course identified a lot of examples of development projects that did not work, or at least not for the poorest people. For example, resettlement projects, including one funded by a UN agency, and I say this, I have a past history of also working for the UN, but where the people ended up coming back to their original areas where they had settled and rebuilding their shanties for a number of reasons. There are also examples of government funds that had been given to create income-generating cooperatives, but without any form of training or management support or any other kind of support to the people, and so only the better-off people in the community were able to take advantage of the funds. And no doubt many of you here can tell similar tales of failed projects, which were a waste of resources, but also a source of great disappointment and great distrust among the people for ever becoming involved in any other development projects. So in all of these cases, none of the elements of responsibility, answerability, and enforceability that Ignacio talked about were components of there were talked about, none of those three were present. But I'll give you an example of one that was also funded by UN agency that was implemented with support from ATD Fourth World that did give, that is an example of a very different kind of results. It addressed the rights of a community that lived by recuperating and selling items from the garbage dump next door, or that they lived next door to. So the project recognized that extreme poverty is the result of multiple forms of discrimination, not just an issue of earning a living, and therefore it included a whole range of interventions in the projects. But first of all, the community was involved in mapping the families and establishing criteria for what they felt like constituted extreme poverty and the people then that therefore should be eligible for an unconditional cash transfer program that was combined with vocational training. The families monitored the program and its results through monthly focus group meetings, which also then strengthened solidarity within the community and also strengthened the people's capacity to analyze the issues and then to articulate them and to express them then to the local authorities that they met with. The adults received ID cards, the children received birth registrations, and therefore the families were able to send their children to school, to access health care. They were able to improve their houses and to launch new income-generating activities because of the training and the support that was provided. So the cash transfer program has now ended, but the majority of the families who participated in it are continuing to benefit from it because of the income, the new income-generating activities that they were able to launch and the access to health and education. Key to the program were the rights to information, to participation in decision-making, to expression, to assembly and association that are all process-related rights that are key to accountability. And these rights were encouraged and supported throughout the project. So what is important then to recognize from the successful examples is that ensuring that all people can enjoy their rights requires affirmative action on behalf of those who have suffered from multiple forms of human rights violations. It simply isn't good enough to say, we offer the services, we've created the mechanisms, now if they don't take advantage of them, then that's their own fault. Because for the systems can be put into place and still not have the desired result because not enough attention is given to issues of discrimination and social exclusion. For example, access to free education can be guaranteed, but then the parents' associations makes decisions without making an effort to consult as many parents as possible, and so they end up making the decisions that then are discriminating for children who have few resources. So then how then to build in accountability systems that work for people in extreme poverty and that also guarantee a more effective use of available resources? Obviously, one of the major factors of success has got to be a genuine political will to create more equitable societies. Otherwise, it's going to be a very tough road. But in terms of specific mechanisms, here are some of the lessons that we have learned in terms of social accountability mechanisms. One is creating mechanisms such as focus groups, community groups, etc., through which the local population, supportive NGOs, and responsible public authorities can gather to carry out regular evaluations of key services as well as law enforcement practices, and this whether they're public or private. But here, why it's important to take care of that all of the voices in the community are heard in one way or the other. And our experience has been that often this kind of dialogue and direct contact between people gives better results than confrontation when dealing with people with a long history of discrimination. Secondly, in order to provide redress from rights violations, it's important to give priority to mechanisms such as mediators, ombudspersons, community councils, etc. But here it's important that they are accessible and understood by the people, and that also that people can be accompanied by others to help support them when they try to defend their rights. At the national level, we've seen that intersectoral commissions that include NGOs through which people living in extreme poverty are represented can be very useful because they can provide oversight in the development, implementation, and monitoring of integrated and comprehensive anti-poverty strategies. The guiding principles on extreme poverty that I mentioned before provide a very good compilation of the integrated kinds of actions that need to be taken in order to address extreme poverty effectively. Another recommendation is that before launching new projects, to institute the regular use of social impact assessments carried out in consultation with the people concerned. This is not done enough. And it's sure that these kinds of processes slow down the initiation of a project, but in the long term, the results will be much, much better. It means, though, that the donors have to accept the idea that quick fixes are rarely optimal nor lasting, and instead to invest in longer-term programs. And here by donors, it can be the government, it can be bilateral agencies, UN agencies, NGOs, whoever is involved. And then lastly, I would say that it's important to put in place mechanisms for the people concerned to be able to continue to be involved in the design, implementation, monitoring, and evaluation of the project, and to give support to the community organizations through which they can express themselves without fear of retribution, which is, for many of them, is something that they have suffered in before when they have tried to raise their heads and speak out against the violations of their rights. But in addition to these mechanisms, though, in order for them to work, why it's clear that the governments need to do other things besides just simply putting in accountability mechanisms, which is, for instance, providing human rights training to public officials and using the media to develop public support for anti-poverty strategies. Because a human rights approach to poverty eradication will only work if there's greater support for human rights within the society as a whole, at least in our experience. Yeah. Thank you very much.
And it's a rich experience. We've all watched as ATD Fourth World has been very much involved in bringing human rights into the poverty debate and vice versa. All of us operating now around an understanding of poverty, thanks in large measure also to your contributions, which doesn't look at these narrow notions of poverty focused on income, for example, but looks instead. I need to get closer to the microphone. Is that the signal? Okay. I'll bring the microphone closer to me. But instead, looking at poverty as deprivation of security and power, as you emphasized, and the choices necessary for an adequate standard of living without discrimination and other human rights, and that really turns it on its head and makes the kind of social accountability you're talking about absolutely essential. The kind of emphasizing a voice that you're talking about so essential. So thanks for that. Let me move now to Aldo Cagliari from the Center for Concern. And we're looking at the local level, and I'm going to bring it all the way up now to accountability at the international level. The book does look at notions of international accountability, as Ignacio mentioned. Maybe you can give us a few thoughts on that before we get into the discussion as well. Aldo.
Thank you very much, and I want to start by thanking the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights and Center for Economic and Social Rights for the opportunity, the invitation to be here. And part of my comments are going to be drawing upon a paper that you are going to find that has been published by the Harvard University Center for Health and Human Rights. It's an analysis of Millennium Development Goal 8, and it's a part of a multi-author study. Other authors have done papers on the other MDGs. I have particularly looked at Goal 8. And I want to speak about international mechanisms for accountability, particularly on finance and human rights. I think this is an area where what Ignacio said about the weaknesses in some of the goals that actually make it more difficult to ensure accountability, nowhere is that truer than in Goal 8, where you'll find that there is none of these goals actually has a number or a time attached to it, as opposed to the other goals where there are numbers. In this one, you will not find numbers. But from a human rights perspective and accountability to the human rights framework, the most interesting thing about Goal 8 is that it is a goal that's sort of like a standalone. I think there was a hope that by juxtaposing this goal about means of implementation with the other goals, which are more really goals, With maternal mortality reduction or poverty reduction, etc., that this juxtaposition somehow magically would ensure that goal 8 was related to those other priorities. And actually, there is no mechanism in the MDG framework or any other mechanism to ensure that that actually is going to happen and to track down whether that is happening or not. So to track down whether what is being done on aid, on debt relief, on trade is actually contributing or is being detrimental to the other MDGs, which means that basically we could have hypothetically achieved, I would not say achieved because there is no way to know if you achieved goal 8 because there are no targets to know if we got there, but you could have a substantial increase on any of these areas, market access, debt relief, etc., and you have no idea if that is being good or bad for the other MDGs and certainly for human rights. And that is something that the post-2015 development framework really has to tackle head-on. And I was asked to talk about a mechanism of accountability that I was familiar with and in this regard, in this area, to draw some lessons. And I thought of speaking about two of them. One of them is the Financing for Development Conference and its follow-up mechanism. And I think it's very pertinent because you may remember at the time the Financing for Development Conference 2002 Monterrey was assumed to be the conference dealing with the means of implementation for the agenda that had been agreed in 2000, for the agenda of the MDGs. And this conference was conceived as a very holistic conference, looking at all sources of finance in a comprehensive way. This was something that hadn't been done before, and I think also from a human rights perspective would have been, it would be a very important feature to preserve. I'll get to that at the end, but the idea that you cannot just look at certain sources of finance isolated from others because you may actually be canceling out what you do with one source of finance with what happens in another source of finance. So I think you really need to put all of them together to really appreciate the impact that they are having on human rights. So this was the concept of the conference, and it had a follow-up with three layers, a series of high-level dialogues with the ECOSOC and the Bretton Woods institutions, UNCTAD and the World Trade Organization, also high-level dialogues periodically with the General Assembly and those other actors, and follow-up conferences. So three layers of follow-up, and you think that that ensured a very robust follow-up, but the reality is that that was not the case. If you look at what happened in 2008, which was the first review conference, and the review conference would be like the highest level of follow-up you can have in this architecture of follow-up in the Financing for Development Conference. And in 2008, actually, governments were struggling, we were also struggling, to make sure that at least the language of 2002 would be preserved, not make any progress. Let's not talk about progress. Just make sure that it was going to stay there. So that gives you a sense, I think, a benchmark of how weak the follow-up was in the conference. There was an agreement to hold the follow-up conference, whose date should be agreed by the end of this year. Actually, the language is ambiguous, whether the conference should happen or whether the date should be agreed by the end of this year is ambiguous. In the end, the second interpretation has prevailed in practice, so we are still waiting to know, and we hope by the end of the year we will know when the date of the next conference is going to be. There was a proposal, because the follow-up had been so weak, to have a commission on financing for development. That would be like similar to the Commission on Social Development, on Sustainable Development, tabled last year, and it failed. There was no agreement to have that commission in place. So in general, I think we can draw some lessons from financing for development that I'll get to that in a second. Before, I want to talk about another mechanism of accountability at the international level, which is the Economic and Social Council. And you think, well, this is the body of the UN. It is not a mechanism of accountability. But I think when you look at financing and trade policies, the role of ECOSOC potentially becomes very important. The idea under the United Nations Charter was that the Economic and Social Council, in fact, would be a body that would be smaller in number, that would make it more executive, and it will coordinate the work of all the specialized agencies of the United Nations. This includes, of course, the World Bank and the IMF, which are specialized agencies of the United Nations. And in that initial conception, should have included what was a trade organization. That did not happen. In the end, when the World Trade Organization was established, it was established outside of the UN, which has a range of consequences also. In terms of creating a new architecture, a new body of law that could be even at odds, at cross purpose, with the body of law of the United Nations, and that made it hard to check whether to make that whole organization accountable in the way that specialized agencies were. But in fact, the reality also of how the World Bank and the IMF behaved was that they entered into relationship agreements with the UN, which had a different language than the relationship agreements that were entered into by the other specialized agencies. So as opposed to other specialized agencies, the World Bank and the IMF are only required to give a consideration to recommendations from the UN to request to put items on the agenda, for example. And this has, I would say, undermined the capacity of what could have been potentially a very important mechanism for accountability as far as economic policies are concerned, because as we know, the Bretton Woods institutions have a lot more sway on economic policy today than the UN has. So what are the lessons? I think we could rescue from the Financing for Development follow-up mechanism the idea of a comprehensiveness of all sources of finance. I think this was a very positive aspect. A post-2015 mechanism for accountability on this field would have to incorporate that. And also a multi-stakeholder approach. This is the other particular aspect of this was a conference that put a lot of emphasis in bringing all stakeholders to the table, and this included civil society and the private sector. And if we are talking about accountability from the bottom up, certainly this would have to be a multi-stakeholder approach with that level of inclusivity. From ECOSOC, the idea that the body would have to perhaps have a limited number of members and the idea of having a place where what different agencies are doing has to be coordinated and coherent. From both of them, I would say you have to rescue the fact that they are housed at the UN. I think in this post-Westphalian time in which we are living, we probably the most we can hope for a mechanism for accountability is peer review processes, and those should happen in the organization which has a universal membership. Plus, I think it would be important to ensure the high-level participation. It would be very important that any mechanism has at least one meeting in the year where you have heads of state getting together and evaluating progress, surrounded, of course, by some lower-level preparatory meetings that the high-level the idea of a high-level policy forum that was agreed in Rio at the Rio conference last year, I think makes us hope that maybe this is not so far-fetched, so difficult to have. But every time that the idea of having a body that would meet at heads of state level at the UN comes up, like for example, in 2009 was the debate around the Global Economic and Social Council, immediately we get presented with the alternative, we have ECOSOC for that, so we just have to strengthen and reform ECOSOC. I think when we say that, we have to remember that ECOSOC has been under reform for the last 40 years, more or less, and it hasn't really changed, its capacity to do that proper job. We certainly, if we talk about that, we will have to talk about a reform of the relationship agreements to ensure that there is a more binding capacity from the resolutions that come from ECOSOC for the Bretton Woods institutions, include the WTO into that, include also financial standard setting bodies, because in this post-financial crisis, post-Great Recession time, we also cannot eliminate or leave out of that framework the Basel Committee on Banking Supervision or the Financial Stability Board or other bodies that develop financial regulations. The idea of having a body with a small number of members, I think also there are reasons to be more hopeful about that with the experience that we are seeing now with the Open Working Group, that you could have a constituency-based body, which a smaller number of members that doesn't include all of the members at the table, but actually that represent all of them in an accountable way. And there have to be negotiated outcomes. If this may seem difficult to do sometimes, to have a negotiated outcome every year, but the G20 meets every time, has a negotiated outcome. And I think what really attracts the attention of all stakeholders and certainly of civil society is that some negotiations are going to happen and something is going to be agreed at the end as a sort of common view about how the evolution, how the implementation of decisions is evolving. And if we don't have that, if we have like a summary of the chair or the equivalent of that in a way that the process loses its appeal for many of the external actors and becomes sort of more of an internal UN game, and when we talk about accountability of economic policy, certainly it cannot be an internal UN game. It has to be something that covers a much broader set of actors than that. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Aldo, for an overview of what's happening at the international level, what the challenges are. Clearly, you know, you would think in the wake of a global financial crisis, which was probably the most massive failure of international governance, that everybody agrees was a massive failure of international governance, the notion that there isn't a need for meaningful reform at the international level of these institutions and processes, I don't think anybody could say that without blushing today. And nobody does, that's for sure. So why not seize the opportunity to try to get better mechanisms of accountability at the international level? I think the peer review idea is an interesting one. We have, I think, an interesting example in the Universal Periodic Review of the Human Rights Program, which I think has gone beyond the expectations of many people. I mean, why would member states agree to be bound and to hold each other accountable in a universal mechanism? The answer is because it's universal. And so far, I think it's proven itself to be quite a good functioning, if nascent, mechanism. So absolutely, I think this has to be a part of the discussion. MDG 8 has not delivered, I think it's fair to say, anything, because it wasn't designed to deliver anything particular. And so this whole idea of accountability or a lack thereof in the MDGs is very well captured by what happened with MDG 8. And I think that's the mandate for the next phase. We've got one more brief presentation of 7 to 10 minutes before we open up the floor to all of you. But it's a good one because we spoke about national level accountability mechanisms. And the challenge here then is how to integrate the political mechanisms at the national level to ensure that this is a part of the public agenda, that there's public accountability, and parliaments clearly have a role in that process. So nobody better to speak about that than the IPU and Alessandro Motte. Alessandro.
Thank you. I will start out by saying generally that, yes, parliaments do have a key role to play in accountability, both horizontally vis-à-vis the government and system of checks and balances, and vertically from the people to the government, and also from the national to the international. I tried to also get a little bit into how that mechanism maybe is taking place and may be improved upon. But, of course, the reality of the matter is that this remains a challenge for many parliaments still to fully fulfill this role of accountability. And I will try to say a few words about how that is the case. But before I actually dwell more deeply into the role of parliaments, let me also make a couple of general observations about these international agreements, the MDGs, now the SDGs, and others in general, and what they mean from the perspective of accountability. The truth of the matter is that these agreements do not always aim for the highest possible point. Often they aim actually for a fairly low common denominator, because it is common and that's what they can agree to. So the strength of the human rights framework for accountability, I think, is very evident already at that level, because at the national level, no matter what comes out from the international process, governments and parliaments have grounds for keeping a certain standard in the implementation of human rights, no matter what is the commitment expressed at the global level. I think that's very important. And secondarily, a lot of disagreements and the goals are not prescriptive at the policy level. They don't necessarily say how are we going to do this or that. There is a great example in your book on the goal for a universal primary education. It says, well, it doesn't say how, whether it should be a fee for schooling or it should be free. The human rights framework says it should be free. So it's great to have that framework at the policy level and within national domains, because you cannot deviate no matter what comes out from the international arena. And of course, there is reason why internationally they tend not to be prescriptive, because there is the potential of the one-size-fits-all trap and the question also legitimately of policy space. Governments are claiming that space for themselves. In general, also, I should say, that accountability is also partly a function of ownership. If you don't feel that it's yours, then you forget about it, to put it very bluntly, or you don't go after the goal. So it is important, certainly when it comes to parliaments especially, that from the get-go they have a sense of this new framework that's about to emerge here at the UN belongs to them as well. The MDGs were a fast deal, if to put it simply. There was no original involvement by parliaments. It took us a long time to get them to assume ownership of the MDGs, and still work to be done. But in this case, I think we are on a better course. Partly, I should say, because of the IPU itself, we have started early to try to involve parliaments in the process. I'm not going to go into the details of that, but there is some optimism that at the end of the day, in 2015, we will have something that already has some traction politically in the houses of parliaments around the world, and then in turn will hopefully strengthen accountability at the implementation level afterwards. Now, to be more specific about the role of parliaments, I said there is both a national dimension and an international dimension to this. In both cases, I would want to premise this discussion by saying that accountability is not an event, but it is a process, one that takes painstaking work on a daily basis. Although we like to think of specific milestones, and we ourselves often refer, and I will do it myself later on, to the importance of national periodic reviews and whatnot, what happens in between is also very important. Also because there is often not a linear a cause and effect in the way things develop in reality in national arenas. So when there is failure for the achievement of a goal, unless you have been there in the thick of things on a daily basis, you cannot really see who has been responsible for what. So it's very important to keep that perspective in mind in general. Now, I was saying at the national level, let me begin there. I argued there are some challenges for parliaments. And of course, there are political and institutional requirements for parliaments to exercise this accountability role to the full. Politically, at the very minimum, parliaments have to be duly representative of the people and of all interests of the people, beginning with the poor. And I think we heard some excellent words about that, the involvement of the poor, from one of my colleagues here on the panel. And of course, women, minorities, all of these groups are traditionally excluded. If we want to make inroads in the future, we need to have parliaments that are truly representative of all of those interests. And then, again, very generally, there's a lot to say about these things. The overarching issue for many parliaments around the world is a relative lack of independence from the executive. So there is something also that needs to change, or be that relationship has to be delineated more effectively in many places, so that parliaments can actually identify responsibility on the executive, demand answers, and when possible, impose sanctions as well, although that's not often the case legally. And the minimum requirements for parliaments to have this political role, of course, is, you know, we know the list, it's a long list, free and fair elections, multi-party systems, effective oppositions, political financing that does not favor interest groups or exclude competitors, and so forth. The institutional requirements for parliaments to exercise this role are also a huge list. I'm not going to go through that. But let's just say what the aim should be at the institutional level, and that is to be able to mainstream the international commitments that come out of this arena here at the UN. And it is far from obvious or easy for parliaments to accomplish that task. To give you an example, the NDGs, we know that many parliaments in the wake of the NDGs have gone about to develop specialized committees or caucuses for the NDGs. But when we actually studied them closely, we realized there were many gaps in the way these committees actually work. They are disassociated from the rest of the parliamentary machinery. They lack resources, all kinds of issues. So mainstreaming these commitments remains a big challenge. And underpinning all of this at the institutional level is a question of parliamentary support in general. What kind of funding is available, especially from the donor community when it comes to developing countries' parliaments, to strengthen the accountability role of parliament and the oversight role? The truth of the matter is that a lot of funding that goes towards parliament by necessity is official aid. And official aid is negotiated between governments. So the tendency is to shortchange the parliament, if you will, because governments have a sort of a prerogative for themselves to dispose of this aid. Again, I'm skipping over many, many things. Forgive me. At the international level, the interesting thing is, of course, there, it's a totally different animal. There is no world government or, you know, it's a completely different structure or architecture. And so you have to look at accountability, international accountability, still as something that has to be generated from the inside out, meaning from the national level. And that is certainly the approach that we take at the IPU. And that means basically making sure that parliaments are fully informed of what transpires at the international level, what is their government's position in these processes, and make sure that parliaments are able to demand for reports from the governments about what they're doing to implement their commitments, ask questions and hold debates. But then there is also another way to accomplish this international accountability role, and that is to try to entrench that same role within the international agreement itself. And a case in point is precisely now the SDGs. The IPU has a strong position that there ought to be a governance goal among the SDGs, one that clearly articulates, will be articulated along three axes of representation, transparency, and accountability. And that in that mix, there should be a clear statement with targets and indicators that has to do with the role of parliament in fulfilling precisely these functions. And to that effect, the IPU is also working on a dashboard of indicators for parliamentary strengthening that hopefully will be adopted at the end of the day if there is a governance goal. And that will be a commitment for governments to actually assist with the strengthening of parliaments in a spirit of the mutual accountability approach as well that the moderator was referring to. Of course, and all of this, I'm giving a sign. let me just say, skip a few things, and go to specifically how do we maintain accountability for human rights at the international level. As I said, all of the work of Parliament, ideally, should be vetted from a human rights perspective. Whatever Parliament, whatever comes out of Parliament or proposed by the government by way of legislation, the budget process, and so forth, should be vetted by Parliament from a human rights perspective. That is the ideal case scenario, to ensure that human rights are entrenched in legislation and in the work of government at the national level and also internationally. The truth is that that is, still remains a challenge. In the report, there's a reference to the fact that something like 110 parliaments dispose of human rights committees. But those committees, in fact, are not entirely yet positioned to do that sort of a comprehensive human rights review of legislation, for example. They have generally a more narrow focus, and in each case is different. Funnily enough, in many countries, the focus of those committees is to look at human rights in other countries, but not in their own arenas, and when it applies across the board to social, economic, and political rights. So that, to give you a sense. The good news is that now, with the Human Rights Council and the UP Universal Periodic Review, I think there is potential for a momentum to be gained in there. Because, as you know, those reviews entail governments filing a report with the Human Rights Council and having to explain it. The APU position is that, borrowing from other practices, such as what we've done with the CEDAW committee, that we will want parliaments fully informed of these reports, and also these reports themselves to be debated within parliaments before they are filed with the Human Rights Council. I think that's a potentially very strong way and a leading example of how this international accountability transmission chain can take place specifically to the human rights domain and across the board. Of course, it remains a challenge whether how Parliament can vet these national reports for the reason I just mentioned, that specialized human rights committees are not necessarily endowed to do that on their own, and they need to be better organically linked to the rest of Parliament. So there is work to be done there. A couple of final words. Another important process that I think can link parliaments to the international level is that of national progress reviews, precisely in view of such as we've had in the case of the NDGs, and certainly we will have for the SDGs going forward. There will be specific milestones, and government will be asked to report on their accomplishment, on their implementation of the SDGs. At the national level, that means that there is an exercise going on, led by the UN, typically, or assisted by the UN, with the government, to assist in that review. And a challenge has always been for us how to get Parliament already inserted in that machinery, so that it's not just the government that talks to the UN and other partners as to evaluating their own work, but Parliaments are also part of the discussion so that they can also check for what is actually transpiring for those exercises. And then finally, of course, really conclude the example of the Human Rights Council in Geneva, but also here in New York. It is becoming more and more a practice for parliamentarians to join the national delegations to the UN and to these international meetings and fora. There will be, and we've done that at APU, we have assisted with that, and we think that that's also a very good way to promote the sense of national parliaments being involved in promoting supporting accountability not only within their domains but also internationally. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alessandro. I think a very, very useful oversight of the role that parliaments can play, even if they don't always play that positive role in terms of human rights and development. So many good models, specialized parliamentary bodies that can play that role, even if they haven't always, as you've pointed out. You know, some parliaments have to issue statements of compatibility with policies that are adopted vis-a-vis international human rights standards. Australia, an example that we read in the book here, the use of impact assessments, investigations, consultations, parliamentary inquiries, all of those can be mechanisms that can be used to enhance accountability. And as the report points out, in some cases are, but certainly needs more of that. It's a point of advocacy, isn't it, that parliamentarians themselves had to be held to account, to hold to account government on issues relating to human rights and development. Those are our panel presentations. That means we still have some time to get some input, questions, and comments from those of you who have joined us in the room. I was just thinking as we were having this discussion, people always talk about the group of men in a dark room in the basement of the UN who drafted the MDGs. I think this might have been the room. So here is your here is your chance in a not-so-dark room in the basement of the UN to give some input into the accountability question that will help to frame the post-2015 agenda. Those of you who'd like to take the floor, ask a question or make a comment, please first do identify yourself, identify any affiliation, if you can keep it brief so others that can intervene. And if you've got time left at the end, I'll give an opportunity for some feedback from members of the panel. But let's turn it over to you. All you have to do is raise your hand. And we'll start in the back of the room here.
Yes.
Sorry, you'll have to get to a microphone, and let me remind you, when you take the floor, you're on television, or at least you are on the webcast and on YouTube, so that's your last warning. You look great.
Okay. Thanks. Thank you, Craig. My name is, and thank you for the seat. My name is Barry Herman, and gosh, I have a lot of affiliations, I guess, social justice and global development. But actually now I'm also doing some work in DESA. And so I wanted to correct three things. The first, that the MDGs were not done in the basement of the UN by delegations. They were done on the 38th floor in the office of the Secretary General. Which is a, you know, an important point of contention. The first, though, is the comments about MDG-8, Aldo and you and perhaps some others. The Secretary General, I think, was quite aware of how imperfect the MDG-8 was. And in, so in 2007 created the MDG Gap Task Force, which monitors the original targets and indicators, but adds others. And it produces an annual report. The next one, the SG, will launch in September. In that regard, there's more monitoring now. Is it a case, is it effective? Well, I was at a breakfast for journalists in Berlin organized by the One Campaign, and I can tell you there are strong limits to name and shame. I mean, that it wasn't news. So that's something for the future. Secondly, Aldo, I think you distorted a little bit the financing for development. It was not created to implement results of the conferences in the 90s or what was in the Millennium Declaration. It was an initiative of originally a group of Latin American countries who thought that that developing countries should have more of a role in systemic policy matters. And as part of the coalition that fostered the creation of the Monterey process, of course, implementing the MDGs became part of it, but it had a much broader scope from the beginning and much more so than the Millennium Declaration. Thank you.
Thanks, Professor Herman. Thanks for reminding us that the MDGs were not drafted by a small group of guys in the basement, but by a small group of guys in the attic. I'm going to see if we have a few more, and I'll give an opportunity to Aldo and other members of the panel to reply to Professor Herman's comments, but let's see if we can take a few others before we go here. Yes, here, Shireen.
Thank you very much. Shireen Said from UNDP. Thank you very much for the panel discussion and also congratulations on the publication. I think it's extremely timely, given that we're going into the post-2015 discussions. And several of the comments, and of course, listening to some of the discussions in the post-2015 process are very, very true in the sense of we really are in an era of accountability, and we're seeing the emergence of institutions which we're also anticipating and expecting them to go beyond just the narrow mandate that they have been confined to in some regard. Some of them obviously have expanded, but not sufficiently within the context of human rights standards, as an example. And my point really is, when we're looking at accountability at this point in time, we really need to be cognizant of the power relationship that we have, whether it's between states, its people. I'm very loath to use the word citizen because we are in this environment where migratory patterns have left large numbers of people outside of the framework of citizenship particularly. But the point of it is whether we're looking at those homegrown solutions that Janet spoke about and who funds them to allow them to nurture and for which many people are quite familiar with, whether they're supported institutionally, politically, and also financially. At the same time, when we look at some of these other institutions, the quick fixes are not necessarily allowing them to expand and be nurtured. So it's a question of how do we also incorporate the power relationship as we move towards unbundling the strategy. Of course, the human rights framework is the equalizer. But as we've noted in these international agreements, the disconnect between what is said in meetings and what goes into instruments remains. Paper rights in many respects, but implementing this beyond just the paper rights or whatever the lowest common denominator will be is important. But it's the framework and the strategy, and it really is a change management, which is what the corporates use. But I'm not sure that we within the human rights community have sufficiently set out our strategy to maintain and manage that dynamic and put it in the kind of strategy that enables a culture of human rights to be implemented, developed across all sectors and within the various levels. So maybe some comment on that. I haven't read the report, even though Julia sent it to me a week ago, but it would just be very important for us to perhaps reflect on this and maybe other future discussions. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Shireen. We'll give a chance to the panel to answer that very compelling intervention as well. Others who would like to take the floor at this stage? Yes, here in the center row. That's okay. We'll come back to the back row after you.
Thank you very much. My name is George Sparrow. I'm from the delegation of Liechtenstein. And I would like to thank you and all the panelists for the very valuable input and the food for thought, in particular for the presentation of the publication, which we hope will have a big impact. I haven't had a chance to look at it in detail, but it certainly comes at a very good time for us. We believe, of course, with you that the link between the human rights agenda and the sustainable development agenda is a very strong one and a very important one, and it's one of the major lessons learned from the MDG campaign and should be one of the major elements to feed into the SDG campaign. And we believe we have come some way from Rio, where we had an acknowledgement that human rights are essential part of the legal framework that should be the framework for the development of the appropriate indicators and targets. And now, of course, the next step we are dealing with right now is how to develop those targets and particularly value the input from civil society and NGOs, which are very active at this stage, to feed into the process. My comment is one that is to try to raise a little bit of concern at this stage, because even if we manage to get the targets and the indicators right this time, as far as human rights, non-discrimination, inclusiveness are concerned, we still have to make sure that we get the governance part right as well. And that is an ongoing discussion as well right now. And that is a discussion that often goes a little bit under the radar, as far as we could tell. There has been an agreement that the previous governance structure, the Commission on Sustainable Development, has not worked. And there has been broad acknowledgement that one of the main reasons it has not worked is because it lacked teeth. It lacked a mechanism, a process to ensure its mandate is discharged, and that is ensure the implementation of past commitments. Now, only, let's say, a year later from Rio, mm-hmm. we are at a serious risk to end up with a successor body, the High-Level Political Forum, that doesn't include any sort of mechanism that would actually improve the previous institutional framework. And there is a very little political support at this stage to get to such a mechanism or a process in whatever form it may be. And therefore, I believe political support that we that is needed right now, including from civil society and from the human rights community, is crucial at this stage when we actually try to get the governance side of the story right as well. And I hope that your report can contribute to that, and I certainly hope to continue the discussion, maybe also with people involved in those processes right now. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for reminding us how this struggle actually began in Rio, and then the important provisions, thanks to active delegations like your own, I have to say, in the Rio outcome document that talk indeed about framing these things in ways that are coherent with international law, international human rights standards. At least the starting point is done, but the challenge remains politically to get those institutions right, and I think the panel will give them 1 minute each on these. I'm going to take one more because we're effectively out of time, but I want to give literally 1 minute to each of the panel members to come back after I take this last question.
Hi, Fabio Palacio, International Movement ATD Fourth World. My question is probably best addressed to Mr. Ignacio. I think you guys have done a really good job of showing that we have this problem, which is a development agenda, and this accountability and how to enforce it properly. And then there's also, you have showed a solution, which is this human rights structure framework and like this ability to enforce and be more accountable. And it seems like the missing link to me is, do people really believe that poverty and development is a human rights issue? And I think Janet did a good job of showing that the guiding principles is like a great place where you can look to see like, yeah, extreme poverty is a human rights issue. Therefore, we can link these two things. I'm curious if you think there are any other points where people like us, like civil society organizations or member states can see, look, here's more proof that poverty and development is a human rights issue. Or if there's any other, you know, things that could be coming in the future that could help us create this link. Thank you.
Great question. Thank you very much indeed. So we're going to come back to the panel now. I don't know, for example, Aldo, on Professor Herman's question about the origin of the financing for development, its relation to this process. Shireen from UNDP raised the issue of how to use these accountability approaches to confront the power realities. I think she's talking about power imbalances in many respects here in actually getting it implemented. The delegation of Liechtenstein, who raised the challenge of the governance piece, both in terms of the international mechanisms that are being set up and governance, I think, more broadly. And then our final comment from ATD Fourth World about how to what other advice can be given on making the link between, on the one hand, development and poverty questions, on the other hand, human rights in a compelling way. Let me give you a maximum of 1 minute each to come back to you on the panel. Janet, we'll start with you on any of those you'd like to pick up, and with that, I'll start my stopwatch.
One comment on the governance issue. It is a huge challenge, but I think though that in addition to looking at the, you know, and obviously when we talk about the post 2015, we're looking at international governance, but I think within that, that's where the whole issue of having universal goals, but within targets that then can be adapted to the local level are very important, because governance is not just an international issue. It's also an issue at the local level, the community level, the national level, and so that it. I think we need to look at ways in which we can begin to advance on some of these unequal power relationships at all the various levels. And it may be then some countries we're going to be able to advance only at the community level or the regional level, and not at the national level. But all of those levels are important, and I think we need to keep to look for entry points wherever they may be at all levels. Thanks.
Substantive, relevant, to the point in 49 seconds. Wow. Let me now give the floor to Ignacio for any of those points you want to pick up for 1 minute.
Okay, 15 seconds on each question. I'm glad, Professor Herman, you mentioned the MDG Gap Task Force. I think it has been an important mechanism for reviewing compliance with the MDG 8. I would just say to you all, read the last annual report of the MDG Gap Task Force, and it reads like something an NGO would have written, something we would have written, because it is
NGO.
So fueled, a good NGO like us, because it is fueled by a sense of outrage and despair at the absence of accountability at the global level. Shireen's question, absolutely. I think the value of human rights in this is that human rights unsettles and challenges asymmetries of power. And your question made me think we could start with the process of consultations and challenging power imbalances there, because there are lots of people feeding in ideas, and some voices are getting privileged over others. And I think the kind of voices that ATD are trying to bring into the debate, I'm concerned that they will get smothered. The SDG process, I won't touch that because I don't have time. I'll go to the question that was asked to me specifically. I think the guiding principles to us are so valuable because they're a distillation of why poverty is a human rights issue. And they concentrate all the relevant human rights standards in one instrument. But I think just look around us for examples of why poverty is a human rights issue. Look at what's happened across the Arab world in the recent years. Look at the terrible, devastating, rising, escalating inequality and poverty, even in industrialized countries, being caused by austerity measures and in the wake of the financial crisis. These are all eloquent pieces of evidence that poverty is not natural or inevitable. It's man-made. It usually is men. It's caused by deliberate actions and omissions, and these are profound human rights issues.
Very well said. Aldo Cagliari.
It's very briefly on MDG Gap Task Force. I think what these reports are doing is they are illuminating some indicators that were not reported in other reports, certainly not in reports outside the UN, like the global monitoring report, for example. I have not found myself indicators that were not in the MDG original formulation that the MDG Gap Task Force is adding. But did I distort the financing for development? I think I should have mentioned the systemic ambition of financing for development, which is a very important aspect of it, and which I think makes the weakness of the follow-up even more apparent if one mentions that. At the same time, many governments did say, and I quote actually in this paper that you'll find there, people who actually wrote that in journal articles, that this was the implementation of MDG 8. And I think for many governments, that was the political position, that this was how to expand what MDG 8 had said, how to develop that and elaborate on that. So,
thank you very much. Alessandro, the final minute to you.
Just two words, also to strengthen on governance again. I agree, it's not just international, it's the national dimension, and that is primarily where we're coming from. And it's not just about governments and relationship with citizens, but it's across the spectrum. For example, corporate governance, I think, is something that we would like to have addressed in the SDGs, in this one goal that we're promoting, environmental governance and so forth. On the question of enforceability, it would be great to have new bodies with teeth internationally, but that's really not likely to happen. But what can happen is precisely what we're arguing, that is that you have strong bottom-up accountability processes with parliaments, of course, in the mix, that can make that happen. But I would not necessarily expect new bodies to be created internationally that would have some sort of enforceability mechanism embedded into them. What we can hope, though, is for a better delineation of responsibility as part of this conversation that's taking place on the global partnership, and that would replace eventually an NDG 8, and that IPU is also very much involved in as part of the DCF process.
Thank you very much indeed. Let me just finish with one quote from the book that I think gives you a good sense of the importance of what it is we're talking about. This is from the High Commissioner for Human Rights, Navi Pillay. In the opening to the book, she says, "As we approach the year 2015, from Tunis to New York to Santiago, a resounding call is being heard for a social, political, and economic order that delivers on the promises of freedom from fear and freedom from want. Civil society everywhere are calling for meaningful participation, higher levels of accountability for governments and international institutions, and an end to discrimination and exclusion, a better distribution of economic and political power, and the protection of human rights under the rule of law. The peoples of the United Nations are speaking, often at great personal risk, and the degree to which their legitimate concerns are heard and reflected in the post-2015 agenda will determine both the legitimacy and the success of that agenda. Accountability matters, human rights matters, and I thank you all very much. You matter as well in this conversation. Ignacio Saez from the Center for Economic and Social Rights, Janet Nelson from ATD Fourth World, Aldo Cagliari from the Center for Concern, Alessandro Moter from IPU, Mac Darrow, who's not with us but who is with us in spirit from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights, all of you in the room, and certainly those following on the webcast and on YouTube, thank you very much.